Good afternoon and welcome to this lecture on youth activism. I thought when asked to introduce Jay Naidoo that of course he doesn't need any introduction. We all know about his illustrious history in Kasatu, in the cabinet of President Mandela, where of course he was responsible for the RDP, and he has since gone on to do very important work in other sectors as well. But I did think that I would want to tell an anecdote about Jay, and I asked him if I might do so. When he was in the cabinet and President Mandela started wearing open-neck shirts instead of going around in suits and ties, Archbishop Tutu was extremely upset about this, and he went public on the subject of the fact that it was not dignified enough for the president of a country to walk around with these open-neck shirts. And Jay's response to that was, "That's rich coming from a man who wears a frock." And I've just broken a glass by mistake. So with that, please enjoy the lecture that Jay is going to be giving.
Thank you. So, good afternoon. You know, there's often things that get lost in translation. So when I was invited to come to the summer school, I was the one expecting to be the oldest in the room. So I've discovered something. There are different versions of summer school. So the one that I remember is like 15-year-olds. And they would ask me like really tough questions. So I didn't prepare anything because I was going to say, what do you want me to talk about? So I really want to see this as a conversation because I'm sure many of you have very burning questions that you have. I don't promise to have all the answers, and I don't think anyone in the current situation we face in the world has a blueprint for how we solve the big global challenges that face us today. But the subject is really interesting because it takes me back to what was my first exposure to activism. And growing up, you know, I was 4 years old when we were kicked out of our house because of the Group Areas Act. We were the wrong color on the wrong side of the street. So our experience of activism was driven by reality. It wasn't an academic exercise. You know, I remember asking my parents, why are we leaving? I love this place. I love the mango trees. I love being able to go into the garden and pick bananas from the tree, you know. Why are we leaving? And they said, no, you don't understand. And it was years later I discovered why. And it made me really angry. And you know, consistently through my childhood, I was always told I'd go into a shop. I remember going into a shop called Green Acres and then being kicked out of the shop by the security guard because he said, coolie, what do you want here? You're not going to buy anything. And so being told, well, there's a bus or there's a movie theater, there's a park that you couldn't go into. I mean, I lived in Durban, and you know, Durban is bordered by the Indian Ocean, but we're not allowed to go into the Indian Ocean. So I said, wow, this is really strange, given my Indian ancestry. So activism for us was not hypothetical. It was really concrete and real. And so it shaped from a very early age what I saw as an outlook and stirred a very deep anger in me. And that anger would probably have led to a serious bout of delinquency. But fortunately, you know, I encountered when I was in school still an opportunity to attend a meeting addressed by Steve Biko. And Steve Biko was one of our extraordinary luminaries, charismatic, militant, fiery. And I remember being in a hall like this, a church hall actually, a Lutheran church, and instead of 100 people, there were like 500, 600 people packed like sardines into it. And I remember that in those days security forces monitored every single meeting that dealt with politics, particularly black politics. And they swept into the yard with two big cars. They descended from their cars and they occupied the first room. And with heavy jackets, and obviously you can see their arms under it. Intention to being to intimidate us. And Steve Biko came in, completely ignored them, and spoke from his heart. And I probably was about 14 or 15, and I thought that, you know what? He's absolutely right, because he basically said, you know, you have a choice of either accepting injustice or taking a stand against it. And that is a choice you make as individuals, because as people living under apartheid, you had nothing to lose but your chains. And in fact, it gave me an opportunity to engage with activism in a very real way, and that's my earliest political experience directly in politics. And obviously, as I went into the rest of my high school and then into university, I encountered activism at the university level and at a higher education level. And we saw very soon by involvement in black consciousness, which was a very important part of our history. A large part of that history has never been written about, and in fact is conveniently deleted. But if you look at the changes that came in South Africa, the role of black consciousness was instrumental in modern activism, because it made us confident as people who were black that we could assert our humanity and we could fight for what we believed. And it gave us the confidence then to take on the state. And as I proceeded through university, obviously we ended up in a situation where we saw the limitations of looking at it in purely a racial way, and became exposed to then the writings and teachings of the African National Congress, the Communist Party in South Africa, which has a very different history to the Communist Party anywhere else in the world. And then got exposed to the notion of how does one build community power. And I remember in those early days, in the late 70s, going into communities that were suffering a great deal of disadvantages in terms of houses that were crumbling. In fact, many of the same things happen today. You know, houses that are built that appear with cracks, you know, alcoholic abuse, the way in which rents were being charged, the high transport costs, and beginning a process of understanding how does one organize communities. And the notion being that change was not going to come from individual leaders. It's going to come from the way we change the balance of forces between those that exercise arbitrary power and those that feel disempowered or live under that arbitrary power. And my earliest experiences of community activism were very instrumental. In fact, we worked very closely with what the current Minister of Finance. And I can remember, you know, before we even went into a community, we would sit for weeks preparing. What would we say if the father opened the door, or the mother opened the door, or the younger child opened the door? What happens if they became... it was a difficult conversation. So before you even entered into becoming an activist, you have to go through this really rigorous training about how you deal with responses, whether they're positive or negative, whether they were fearful or whether they were, you know, bold. And that taught us something about how one works with communities and ordinary people. And the most important element of that is humility and the ability to listen. And the difference between activism that is transformative and activism that leads to the notion of the big leader and the cult of personality is activism that is empathetic, that listens, that works with communities, is fundamentally different. It leads to a fundamentally different experience of that community. And so if you look at the transition that we made into the trade unions, that was it. Where did we first start? We started in the hostels. These were the most difficult places to organize workers. They were migrant workers. They were usually from outside the country. They were exploited. They lived in these barracks where hundreds lived in conditions that were, I think, more akin to what you would find in a jail rather than in a decent accommodation. These were dormitories. And you never owned your bed. And you never had privacy. So you occupied your bed in the day if you did the day shift, and the bed belonged to someone else in the night shift. And they were just commodities, numbers. And that's where we started. Because what did we say? You have nothing to lose. If you have nothing to lose, then what do you have to fear? And what we did in the process of building organization, built the most powerful movement this country has ever seen, including across political movements. And COSATU today represents the largest civil society organization that's ever existed in this country, the most powerful and the most influential. Whether you love them or you hate them, they still exist and they still influence where the country goes. But that process of how we were able to take worker leaders and work with them, learn from them, listen to them, and then build ownership of what we were building, made that union movement incredibly powerful. And in spite of massive repression from the state, you know, in which our headquarters were bombed, thousands were detained, buildings were, you know, burnt, intimidation, widespread dismissals. You know, if you just take one, you know, strike in 87, you know, and when the mine workers' strike took place in this country, the largest strike in the country's history, after 21 days, they dismissed 10,000 workers a day. 30,000 workers dismissed. Put onto the buses and shipped back to the homelands or to the countries they came from. Completely rootless. And then blacklisted. Never to get a job again in the mining sector. And so, yes, the struggle that we fought in the past was a struggle really, again, not hypothetical. And I remember going to strikes in Canada and participating in picket lines and going to strikes in Europe and like workers would be organized in the canteen and they would be celebrating and they'd get strike pay. Here it was the complete opposite. But the deep commitment to organization and to activism meant that once you organize one factory and you secured victories, those factories and those members became organizers. And the success of activism is not when you know everything that happens. If you know everything that happens, when I became an organizer in 1979, I could tell you exactly in the factories I was organizing, every single disciplinary hearing, every grievance, every meeting, I could account and detail who was in the meeting, what was said. But I knew that at a certain point, if that's all you know, you're not growing. So the difference between building an organization is very different to building a movement. And so what emerged out of that is this rich and diverse history of South Africa, which was a model for activism in the world, the 80s. The level at which the spark became a bushfire. And there was never an anticipation when we started organizing in the early 70s that 10 years later or 15 years later we would have an organization called the UDF. Or an organization called COSATU. You know, sort of sat down and said, no, we need to now prepare for that. And the interesting thing about it today, when I talk to activists, and I say, why aren't, you know, in a country where the Constitution enshrines the rights that we fought for, why do you feel powerless about exercising the rights? So if you are a parent and you have the school in which your children are, we see that teachers are not doing their work. They're not pitching up at school at time. They're not paying attention to the lessons they should be preparing. The discipline has broken down. The pass rates are at the bottom of the pit. Why are we powerless to do that? Because the Constitution guarantees you the right to quality education. Why do we accept this? We see corruption around us. We remain powerless to do something about it. And you know, often when I talk to activists today, it's like, oh, we have to build an organization, we have to get people interested, we have to have the money to have a meeting. Well, we never had any of those. When we decided to stand up and said we had enough, we are outraged. we didn't sort of say, have you got a budget before I have a meeting? You know? And it's extraordinary that in this short period that we've gone from being one of the most active citizenry in the world about the defense of our rights to a passive citizenry that today sits and this feels powerless about what happens in the country. And so we have to sort of recast our mind as to what is required today. And, you know, the reality of it, even whether it's in this country or whether it is in the rest of Africa, whether it's in the rest of the global crisis that we face today is not unique to us. I think a central challenge that we face today is that we've had, particularly with the end of the Cold War, an extraordinary celebration of greed and of consumption. What I describe as triumphant capitalism, celebrated in our culture, in the way we consume things, in what we see on TV, in what we see in the media. It's a type of system that was doomed to failure from the initial start. But that's what we were captured by. And so today we have a world where that model has run out of steam. That model is a broken model. All they are trying to do is put a bit of elastoplast around it. And so we can spend billions of dollars rescuing bankers so that they can earn the big bonuses again. But we rather screw workers, even in Europe, and retrench them because it costs too much to keep them employed. We rather condemn this next generation, which is sparked off the Occupy movements, because unlike us, which is the majority of us in this room, we are part of this baby boomer generation. A good education guaranteed us a good job. Today your education guarantees you nothing. And part of what we see as this outrage growing in the developed world is the fact of marginalization, as deep as marginalization we have of people living in camps here today, squatter camps. The feeling of hopelessness. That's what we confront in the world today. A loss of trust in the institutions and in the leadership that today controls the world. And we have to ask ourselves as our generation, are we prepared to give up something? And the answer largely is not. We are not going to spend the rest of our lives without our healthcare benefits, without our pensions, without our lifestyle. Even if it means that we're reaching the limits of how much this planet can handle in terms of consumption. And so the next generation has the right to be outraged by what we represent today. And I hope they are outraged. I don't see enough of this outrage. We saw it in North Africa, a sense of outrage at the way in which elites, both economic and political, control power and use the power in order to feed their own parasitic interests and exclude vast majority of people. That is a characteristic of the world today. Whether that's in India, and Arundhati Roy wrote a fascinating article in the Financial Times about 2 or 3 days ago, and she calls up the gush of wealth. It's like oil gush. But what has it done? It's just fed a predatory elite at the top. Today, India has 1/3 of the world's hungry. But it's a country where intellectual capital is celebrated as its biggest strength. But 1 in 3 children is malnourished. That means physically and mentally handicapped in the first 1,000 days. Will never be able to compete. Yet it celebrates its intellectual power as the source of the IT brain power in the world. So as we begin to see that there's increasingly a crisis in the world, a crisis of confidence, a crisis of trust, fueled by a food crisis, where increasingly 1 in 7 people is going to be hungry, and that's going to increase. We have an explosion of a population crisis, which will reach 9 billion people by 2050. We have arable land that is rapidly degrading. We have climate change, you know, and I travel a lot around the world, so recently I was in the north of Kenya. And it's unbelievable to see the impact of climate change. You know, we celebrate the fact that we have a heat wave you know, and that the snow has not snowed as heavily in the North America. But in fact, in places around Turkana, in fact, the site of some of the earliest human hominid fossils in the world, it's a desert. It's like you're being on the moon. These are millions of people whose only means of survival is an NGO dropping them a bag of millis once a month with half a bag of beans and 5 liters of water. Otherwise, they would die of starvation. Where the lakes, the Lake Turkana has dried up, the temperature of the lake has increased, and the fish are dying. So the two things that these populations have been dependent on, which is livestock, which can't exist now because there's no feedstock for them, and fish, which again is rapidly declining. You look at Lake Chad, you know, part of the battle around Darfur is that it's a battle about water and resources. So increasingly we're going to see that. We are seeing the explosion of a similar crisis in West Africa, around Niger. The crisis there is deep-seated. It's in fact so much part of the DNA that the famine in that country, in that part of the world, is going to be worse than what it is in the Horn of Africa. You see villages in Bangladesh that, you know, I mean, if we don't do something about climate change, there will be 20 million climate refugees in West Bengal and Bangladesh. We can see the impact of extreme weather on huge populations. So again, these are not hypothetical issues. These are real issues. And for the first time, I believe there's a chemistry of what I call circumstance, where people in the north that have historically benefited from exploitation of natural resources are beginning to feel the pinch with the economic crisis, the financial crisis, and increasingly the job crisis. I'm beginning to share something in common with people in the developing world. And my biggest hope is that out of that next generation will arise the new leadership that we need in this world. And I think it's going to be a fierce battle, but I say to my own children, who are all now growing out of teenage hall, you will experience more hardship in your life than I've ever experienced in my life. Because there is no guarantee that you have of anything. Whether you will have a planet to even inhabit that, you know, is able to provide the resources to meet your needs. Whether you'll have a job, whether your kids will ever be able to afford education, whether you will survive the conflicts that will come with the fact that we are declining at such a rapid rate in the world. So at the same time, I'm feeling optimistic, you know, particularly given what's happened last year in North Africa. I've been interacting a lot with young people across North Africa. They certainly are on the retreat now. But they're not going to give up. And so what I'm positive about is that I think there's the beginnings of a movement globally which brings people together of the next generation that have a different idea of the world they want. And what we should ask ourselves as our contribution, what is the legacy of the world we leave to our children? And I think if we begin to have that approach, then we can have a dialogue about the compromises that we need to make. As you know, in Africa, particularly South Africa, you know, we are responsible for half of the greenhouse gases in Africa. But that pales into comparison. You know, 4% of greenhouse gases in the world are caused by Africa. We bear the brunt of climate change. But South Africa is responsible for half of that. What do we need to change in how we run our lives? And the same question we're going to have to ask of people in the developed world. What are the changes you are prepared to make in your life so that your children can have a better world to live in? So, that's my trajectory of activism, and I continue to do that. I today chair a global board of an organization called the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, that was initiated in 2003 by Kofi Annan when he was Secretary General of the UN and Bill Gates to tackle the problem of malnutrition that faces 2 billion people in the world. I've been working as the chair, the non-executive chair, but spending almost half my time on that program, on building up this campaign, because hunger, in a sense, represents for me the barometer of human progress. If parents are not able to put food on the table for their children, that is the lowest indicator of our human progress. And that's the destruction of human dignity that we fought so hard for here. So let's open it up and take whatever questions you have and have a discussion. Thank you. Okay. God, I'm usually used to audiences that heckle me. So sure. You want to just say who you are and...
My name is John Geit. One of the problems which I constantly feel we are faced with is the assumptions of economists and people who write about world economies. Somehow, when there is a reduction from, say, a 5% growth rate of a country's national project down to 2%, this is seen as a terrible problem. And in Japan, for instance, that has not been growing as much as people would have liked it to, this is also presented as something that is bad. A lot of the economic growth, which everybody seems to think is such good news, and is projected by The Economist, for instance, as a thoroughly good thing, is based on more production of carbon dioxide. So one of the things is that theory has to change, which underlies how the world works. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I don't have all the answers, but I will comment on that. Other questions? Please.
On the news today, it said that the trade union in the Eastern Cape is objecting to the dismissal of teachers, and schools are closed for days in April. And the man was quite mad and saying that people must demonstrate by any way possible against this decision.
Okay. MYM, yes. Okay. Anything else? Right at the back.
Could you focus your vision of the future a bit on more closely on South Africa as well as on the global considerations?
Right, the last one?
Okay, I'm agreeing with him.
Oh, yeah, agree. No, at the back. Yes.
Last night on television, I heard that the new Protection of Information Bill is now before the National Council of Provinces, where the ANC has a fairly large majority, and therefore likely to be passed. And the only thing that can protect us from that complete shutdown will be the appeals to the Constitutional Court, and President Zuma has already mentioned needing to look at whether the Constitutional Court is reflecting the will of the people. Its actual job is to protect our very cherished Constitution. I know, I believe Kosatu is anti the secrecy bill. Is that correct? What can we do? And do you see a connection between that and the rather indecent haste with which it's being shepherded through, and the potential for fracking in Peru with no information being available, not from Shell, not from the minister concerned, and perhaps that's why.
Thanks. Let's just deal with those issues. You know, John raised a very important issue. How do we measure progress in the world? And that's what I talked about, the sort of failed trajectory of what we see as growth. That all it proposes is that we increase consumption. And we all know, if we're being pragmatic and realistic, there's a limit to which we reach the tipping point when it comes to the environment. And that's not very far away. You know, our failure to have a decisive agreement at COP17 is a disaster on the Kyoto Protocol. The decision of Canada, not even a week later, to pull out of its commitments at COP17 is a tragedy. And I was reading an article recently where one of the top scientists at NASA said that continuing what is the Keystone oil pipeline project, which is to take the fuel generated out of the tar sands project in Canada to the United States to feed its voracious appetite, will be a deadly body blow to the world, to the planet. This is not some lefty organization like Greenpeace. This is NASA saying that. So, you know, we've got at the moment, we have a denialism, very much like the denialism we had here around HIV/AIDS, a denialism at the highest levels of governments around the world that don't see a threat, that think this is exaggerated, that ignore the science. And the only ones that really take this question seriously are Africa, which is suffering the brunt of climate change. It's the island states, which all would be submerged if that climate change climbs above 2 degrees. Which is, if we do nothing, it will. And the projections are not even before 2020. And that's when we end up with the type of devastation we have. So, in a sense, the debate about what is development, what is growth, is long overdue. And we pass the ideology of growth. And I think one of the things that we've got to talk about, given the fact that, you know, we're never going to be able to create formal jobs in the way that we have. You know, you take South Africa as a classic example. The structural challenges we have of creating jobs is not new. We knew it was there. We knew that we should have addressed this before 1994. We made a choice not to. We postponed the problem, the difficult choices we had to make about how we create jobs here. So increasingly the debate in the world is about livelihoods rather than jobs. How do we allow people to earn the type of income that allows them to have livelihoods and to live a life that promotes human well-being? But that debate, when you take it into the circles of bankers and economists and the World Trade Organization, into the institutional arrangements around the world, people laugh at you. And I think we can see it staring at us in our face, and we still pretend it's not a problem, that we can grow ourselves out of the problem. And I think that that's where, in a sense, what we need are the new movements that are raising the debate about what is the growth we want? What is the world we want? How do we go beyond the Millennium Development Targets? You know, it's an extraordinary thing to say, leaders of the world can say, we want to halve poverty by 2015. Well, outside of China and Brazil, we haven't achieved much success in halving poverty. And the economic and ecological cost of the development in China, we still have to encounter into the future. But if you really ask yourself the question, what is the world we want? What is the development we want? How do we ensure sustainability? Who are we to decide this half we will save their lives and that half can die of poverty, of infant mortality, of dying of diseases caused by reasons that we could prevent? We have the technology to prevent. Who are we to give ourselves that authority? So if we want to talk about the world we want, we have to talk about the rights of every single citizen of the world. And I think that's a new debate that is starting now in the world. I think we're very far from the point where we're sitting and negotiating it. I think the powers that dominate economic power and political power in the world still remain tilted in the balance of those that don't see any changes to how the current trajectory is being sustainable. And they think it's a pipe dream. So that's something we will fight about. The issue of dismissal of teachers. You know, an organization like COSATU is a progressive organization. It doesn't mean that everything it does is progressive. It is generally progressive in fact of it representing its members and taking a strong stand. So take a very strong stand on the secrecy bill, vehemently opposed to it, and will challenge it in the Constitutional Court. It's taken a very strong stand against corruption. On the 26th of this month, January, it launches the biggest civil society initiative on corruption called Corruption Watch, which is going to put a huge focus on the corruption that really robs the poor of this country. It's taken a strong stand on Zimbabwe or Swaziland in terms of human rights. But ultimately, it's a trade union federation, and trade unions anywhere in the world defend the rights of their members. That's the bottom line. If you ask a person running a business, you know, you are making tables. Well, you're making tables because you think everyone should have a table, or you're making tables so that you can get a return on your labor and investment and make a profit. So at the end of the day, we must understand we live with contradictions. There are conflicts. There are conflicts and contradictions even within COSATU. And part of the challenge that we have in education is that what is the role of the union? And, you know, this is extraordinary because, I was the convener of the union and I launched it with Nelson Mandela with a commitment that it will fundamentally change how education is delivered in a way that empowers the poor. Well, today we know that millions of people are coming out of the education system with very few skills, no jobs, and unlikely to have a job in their lifetime. And we have to ask ourselves the question, where do you stand in relation to that as a trade union? And I went into the COSATU Central Executive Committee really arguing this view. So yes, you know, a union has to defend the rights of its members, and society has to challenge positions that it will take. And that's our role as society, and our role as government. Muslim youth movement, you know, I mean, I've encountered the Muslim youth movement in its various formations, but I've never been involved at that level. You know, my life took me into organizing communities and then organizing workers. And more broadly speaking, so I'm not sure why specifically the question has come up, but I can't say that I am an authority on the Muslim youth movement. But we did, in building up unions, raid a lot of the youth movements, whether it's Christian youth movement or the Muslim youth movement. You know, the faith-based movements are very good at training people, and what we did is give them politics and put them to work in the communities. So, you know, faith-based groups were, in fact, a really pillar of support for us. And it's extraordinary the experiences I had personally of working with Archbishop Dennis Hurley and the Catholic Bishops' Conference, working with the Methodist Church and Anglican Church, like, you know, when our headquarters was formed, you know, Tutu didn't even raise an eyelid. He said, just come and sit here, you know. And, you know, we are able to survive that very difficult period. So we have worked closely with faith-based organizations and me personally throughout my life. And I've never experienced any type of negative behavior from them. So maybe we could talk about that a bit more. Future of South Africa, I think what fascinating is what is happening today. You know, I think post-apartheid, you know, one of our mistakes, and I was part of this mistake, is that when we won power, political power, we had an ideological position, which is about a developmental state. That once you had control of the organs and levers of power, political power, you would be able to use that political power to redress the past and build a sustainable development path forward that met the needs of people. to deliver on our contract of a better life for all people and address particularly the imbalances caused by apartheid. Well, I was not even 3 months into being in that government when I realized we had no capacity in the state to deliver in much more than what it was doing. A serious crisis of institutional capacity and a bankrupt state. We had a bankrupt state in 1994. 93 cents in every rand was already committed to expenditure. So if we wanted to change things in delivering to the majority of people in this country, we had 7 cents in every rand to do it. So one of the things that we made a mistake on was, one, believing that we were all on the same page, internal movements, the trade unions, the people coming from the Robben Island, the people coming from exile, and actually we weren't on the same page. It was a shock to the system to discover that, but it's something we should have expected. You know, we were all pretty united and unanimous about ridding ourselves of apartheid. But within 6 months of us being in government, the schisms opened between what do we want to replace apartheid with? What is the content of the democracy? And very quickly we discovered that people like ourselves who were internally and fighting in the trenches were outmaneuvered completely. And what was the most important element that held together the society was the manifesto we went to the people with, which is the Reconstruction and Development Program, which provided hope to people that I may not get a house in a year, or 2 years, or 5 years, but the government remains committed to this notion of reconstruction and development. And we destroyed that hope. And created a sense of adversarialism in this country that destroyed a social consensus. And if you look at countries that are successful in the world, countries that in which there is social cohesion, that we have challenges, but we are agreed about what is it we need to do to tackle the challenges. Countries that try to say, I know what is best for you, and you implement top-down, ultimately fail. I mean, you know, the most successful example of that is maybe the Asian tigers, South Korea and China and so forth. But that could never happen here. You can never, in this country, given our history, impose your view on society. And that caused a lot of friction and adversarialism that we still live with today. And we still haven't built a new social consensus. What is the South Africa we want? But interestingly enough, is that we know what we don't want. And the thing about South Africans, particularly South Africans that have come out of oppression, black South Africans, is that we are able to tolerate so many incursions on our what we see as our rights. But at a certain point comes, we say, no, we had enough. And I think that point has been reached now. So if you take the reaction that we've had towards the imposition of the secrecy bill, that we have a ridiculous Minister of State Security that says anyone who opposed the bill is working for some foreign intelligence agency. And so I had a debate with the chief whip on the day they passed the bill. And I said to him, you know what, I am opposed to this bill. Your Minister of State Security said that anyone opposed is working for some foreign intelligence agency. Can you tell me which agency I'm working for? He said, no, comrade, you never, never. So I said, you never repudiated it. So who are you talking about? So the danger is when power becomes so alluring, and power, in a sense, you know, we always talk about, you know, how power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think we've reached a point of paranoia in that respect. So instead of dealing with very legitimate issues that are arising from very important constituencies in the country, we want to pretend that it's a bunch of counter-revolutionaries or it's a neoliberal agenda. But that buys you a bit of time. It doesn't buy you the space to do what you want. And no democracy in the world that we envisage was ever going to give you authority to do what you want. So this stupid notion that because you are elected to go to parliament and you are the government, therefore you have some feudal divine right to rule over us is absolute nonsense. And something that we must never accept. And certainly, it reaches a point where you're starting to see the resistance to that, whether in terms of the secrecy bill, whether in terms of the way the attacks that are coming against the Constitution. And the notion that the Constitution was a betrayal was, as again, absolutely false. The Constitution is one of our most radical documents. And it talks not just about the right to quality education, quality health, accountable government, how do you deal with corruption, what are the second and third generation rights are. But again, it becomes a convenient thing to attack, to try and create a scapegoat for where your problems are. And our biggest problems in this country is not about policy or constitution, it's about delivery and accountability. And so that's the bottom line of what we're starting to see now, the growth of new movements. One of the most successful of those was the Treatment Action Committee, which fought the government on the right to treatment on ARVs and won that battle. And so post-apartheid, that's been one of the most successful examples, but we seem to see the continue to see the rise of new movements. And the old movements like COSATU beginning to assert what are our rights, and no one's going to take our rights from us. So no secrecy bill is going to stop me telling, you know, saying to you or saying in public that it's an absolute nonsense that we should not allow the secrecy bill to be implemented. And bottom line is that I'm waiting for the first minister or police officer to come and arrest me for criticizing. So it'd be very interesting. I was barely never arrested in under apartheid. To be arrested under democracy would be an interesting experience. So you know, the issue of fracking. You know, the thing about it, you know, fracking obviously is not just a problem here. I've seen the same problem in Canada now, that governments have ceded rights to oil companies secretly to continue this experimenting on fracking. But the problem we have with it, it's still very much a middle class issue here, a white middle class issue. And the question we always have, and the debate I'm having with people in Greenpeace, is that you've got to make this an issue that affects ordinary people and that really screws the poor.
Because it will affect everyone.
Yes, but the way in which it's positioned and the way in which you present the issue, the environment still remains a fairly middle-class way of dealing with it. When I look at what the devastation caused to the poorest of the poor in the world, I see the direct impact on food security, on access to water. So I think part of it, you know, for me, all of these things that the government is doing is actually extraordinarily great for us. You know, I welcome them pushing ahead with the secrecy bill, actually, because it gives us a position to build a platform to oppose them. I mean, it's an activist dream, you know, and if you have to, oh, fuck, oh, God, the end, the world is coming to an end, you know. It's like every time the apartheid state tried to impose a state of emergency on us, we used it to mobilize even more people. Every time they detained people, we conducted greater struggles, you know. So, you know, I don't know whether it's a different type of activism we have today, but you know, its backbone maybe a bit weaker than what we had. But you know, I think the challenge we face in the society is also not just saying what you are against. What are you for? You know, we're largely the middle class assembled in this theater today. You know, we will never experience in our lives, or our children, the fact that you cannot put a plate of food on the table for your children, that you may have no roof over your head, or that you may have no job and lost your job and not have a job for the next 10 years. You know, we never understand that what we need to do to change the lives of people on the ground. So we mustn't be so self-righteous to think about just what our issues and feel like so self-righteous that we know everything. We don't know what it is to live in a squatter camp. You know, in fact, most middle-class South Africans have never been in a squatter camp. You know, so you know, I cannot, in a sense, argue, you know, against, you know, what a community may do if it feels very strongly about an issue, about a child being raped and they decide to take the law into their own hands because the police are ineffective. You know, it's not our right to do that. So I think as a balance to the debate we have about what's wrong, ask yourself the question, what am I doing that does give hope to the majority of people in this country that have no hope today. You know, I was part of an NGO that Love Life that did work with young people. And it's very interesting in the townships where we asked in certain communities and focus groups, why is it that you have unprotected sex if you have 1 in 3 chances of getting HIV/AIDS? And you know what he said to me? Comrade, why are you telling us about a disease that will kill us in 10, 15, 20 years' time? We have nothing today. And anyway, the government will give us ARVs. So when you are able to answer that question about what are we going to do beyond sitting here and listening to this, you know, to a lecture, or me trying to be clever and what I think my responses are, when we've done something to give that generation hope, then I think we have the right to be self-critical and to be strong in our criticism. So until that point, as South Africans, let's be critical of what is wrong that government does. Let's praise government where it is right. Let's make our individual contribution. We don't have to wait for government. We don't have to wait for a corporate. We don't have to wait for a civil society. We can today make a contribution that improves the lives of someone. And I think that what we need today in the world are citizens' movements. Movements that don't require you to be told what to do. That you do it because it's the right thing to do. And it's like what we did in the 70s, in the early 70s. No one told us you have to stand up and fight apartheid. We did what was the right thing. We didn't know where we were going to go, whether we lived to see the day. But we did what was the right thing. Anyway, we did some wrong things along the way, but in hindsight, you know, it's a great teacher. So, thank you very much. I have to catch a flight. But it's been an honor to be with y'all. And I hear that there's a whole bunch of students here from the US. Put your hands up. Let me see y'all. Okay, can we give them the last two questions? Okay, ask your question. Come on. Don't be shy. We are very generous here in South Africa. Yes. Okay. Okay, in the back.
Anyway, I have a question actually that I brought up in class a while ago, and it's related to something you mentioned throughout the lecture. You brought up organizations, really, like community organizations, activism, specifically saying that you guys didn't need a budget for the business, but the need level is things that we're mentioning now. And so, particularly coming from the mindset of activism back home, it's more of the latter. People are very focused on
yes, you know, on the first question, you know, I think that the, you know, we're now a teenager. This democracy is a teenager. Now, some of you are still teenagers, you see. I have a teenage daughter and a son, so as parents, you know what teenagers can be, full of hormones and wild and uncontrollable and unpredictable. So in a sense, think of our democracy like that. You know, we're at the stage where the behavior is unpredictable. It needs a firm hand, but it needs guidance and it needs understanding. And it needs a wisdom of leadership that is in power, that understands that we're dealing with a teenager. And I don't think that we understand that yet. I don't think we have that wisdom yet. And particularly because in my generation we have an arrogance about what we did, that we freed the country, therefore don't tell us how to do things. And so it needs a new dialogue, which I don't think is yet there. And in fact, all of these elements of attacks on the Constitution, the secrecy bill, of attacking the judiciary for, you know, usurping the role of the parliament are indications of a leadership that doesn't understand that it needs to dialogue with the next generation, that that doesn't carry the baggage we carry. You know, because if you really look at it, it's, you know, it's now almost 22 years since Mandela was released. So those born in the last 22 years, you know, they're going to be voting in the next election. And the question is, do we understand what they want? And I think we are still locked into that mentality of thinking we know what's best for you. And I am encouraging people like your age to be outrageous. You should be outraged. There's not enough outrage in this country. I was outraged when I was the age of teenagers today, you know, but I don't see the outrage there today. So I think that's one thing. You know, it's like, so I think that they don't have the baggage. In fact, they don't want, you know, they don't want to listen to us lecturing them. But I don't think we have a dialogue yet. And I don't think the next generation really knows what it wants. You know, there's an organization here that's called Equal Education in Cape Town. Very, very good, solid organization that I support. And they have a nice slogan. It says, each generation has their struggle. I think the next generation hasn't found what is their struggle. And when they do that, they will be a force to reckon with. And hopefully it'll happen sooner. On the second question, I think that part of the way in which philanthropy has developed in the world and the way in which states use their resources has created a distortion in the way in which civil society works. So I sit on the global health panel of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I'm part of a discussion on global philanthropy that's taking place now. And in a way, I have a small trust that I have set up myself. But it's, in fact, distorted a lot of what how civil society operates. So if you really look at it, the inordinate amount of time that people put into presenting proposals, developing proposals, monitoring, collecting data that has to satisfy some low-level official that sits in one of these big foundations actually creates huge disruption. I keep telling the Gates Foundation this. You know, every time your program officer picks up a phone and talks to an NGO in Malawi, just making a simple inquiry, you disrupt that organization for 2 weeks. Because they go into a real tiz. Why is it? What are they wanting? What do they need? You know, how have you done something wrong? So in a sense, the way in which we become dependent on the way in which we conduct ourselves, our operational activities, dependent on someone providing funds, whether that's a state or whether that's some big foundation, has become a bit of a double-edged sword. At the same time, philanthropy allows us to take risks that governments will not take. So there are positives and negatives, and I think that a lot of the... And I think, you know, yesterday I was in a session where someone came to present to me a campaign about how to build youth leadership. And it was designed on, you know, some of these big campaigns around, you know, the Red Campaign and, you know, big American campaigns, you know, about, which really is a marketing strategy. I said, you know, a marketing strategy is not selling a product here. You know, it's a very detailed, long, slow, frustrating process to organize a community. You can't go there and like you're selling a brand, you're selling Nike, or you're selling, you know, iPads or iPhones. You don't build organizations like that. You can sell products like that. So don't apply that thing that if I get 30 seconds on CNN, I've made it. Well, you know, this is the problem that we have with some of the luminaries in the world in the development field globally. They feel because they can create a model in one village in India, they are the knights in shining armor that will help us solve our poverty in Africa and Asia. Well, you know, there's 600,000 villages in India. Anyone can create a model in one village. You know, it doesn't take a lot of intelligence or resources to do that. So, as well, you've got to understand that ultimately change, permanent, sustainable change, comes from communities taking power into their own hands and deciding what they want to do. our role is purely catalytic. And we don't need some celebrity coming and tell us how to solve our problems. They can support us. So what I really like about these Occupy movements, and I remember reading something about what they said to Michael Moore when he went to New York and said, listen, you're a great guy, done fantastic things, but sit down and listen. Don't come and tell us about how you've led and fought the struggle for so many years. That's the type of approach I want, where they see people like me as some people that they can interact with, have an intergenerational debate, but my role is to support you. Only you can solve your problems. And that's been our approach historically in this country of why we did liberate ourselves. It wasn't dependent on the big leader, the wise person or the clever person. Our country was liberated by the effort of every single South African. Thank you very much. I really must go now.